Hi, this is Alana from Sauk Hill. I'm the host of There There on WGXC Acra, Hudson, and Catskill. Radio for open ears.
Every Thursday evening from 5 to 7 p.m., Left Bank Ciders in Catskill holds a community soup night. Every Thursday, they gather to eat soup made by members of our community, with all the proceeds benefiting a local cause. The soup is homemade, delicious, and affordable. A donation gets you a bowl, some bread, and lots of camaraderie. There's always a vegetarian soup option, and a different charity or cause gets the funds raised each week. They have held several community soup nights for your community radio station, WGXC. Left Bank Ciders is at 150 Water Street in Catskill, and Community Soup Night is there every Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Spike's Record Rack in Catskill, New York. WGXC local business supporters help us continue to be a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement. Thank you, Spike's Record Rack.
Listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 Music for Open Ears. My name is Sal Cataldi, and we're here for the latest edition of Reading is Funkdamental. This is a monthly show where we talk about books about music. I'm a local musician. I play in a band called Spaghetti Easter Music and Space Heater, and I'm also a writer for the New York Times and NewYorkStateMusic.com, where I review books, probably 60 in the past 2 years. So here we go. This is me talking about some of those books. Today I have on Frank Mastropolo, who's the author of a book called Fillmore East, The Venue That Changed Rock Music Forever, and Joshua White, who was the founder of the legendary Joshua Light Show. So for those who don't know, Fillmore East was really the church of rock and roll between 1968 and 1971. Promoter Bill Graham brought the cream of rock royalty to New York to play on these amazing triple bills where you would get in for $350 to $550. You'd see people like Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, Jefferson Airplane, and so on. He really served Graham as the catalyst for expanding people's taste in music through 1971, when the club was ultimately shuttered. So we're going to speak to these guys today about the book, and really about the whole history of the Fillmore East and the impact it had on rock music. So without any further ado, here we are with Frank Mastropolo and Joshua White.
I'm Joshua White, and I was fortunate when I was very young to be able to do the light show at the Fillmore East, which was known as the Joshua Light Show. Mm-hmm. And I had worked with Bill Graham before, and I had worked with a lot of the people that were running the place. We all came out of Carnegie Tech, which is now Carnegie Mellon University, or NYU Drama School, which was right in the same building as the Fillmore. And so it was just a bunch of people that had known each other for years, and we just happened to come together. And Bill acquired this theater and just the best music in the world. It was really the defining music of that moment in time, which was 68, 69, 70. And I got to do my light show. And the light show was in residence, which meant we didn't have to come and go and come and go. We didn't have to haggle about money. The equipment platform was behind the screen, so we were rear projected, out of the way. and treated very respectfully on the marquee, on the posters.
Yes.
And when you're in a situation like that, it just gets better and better.
Yeah.
And it gets better and better.
Well, let's hear from you, Frank, a little bit about your writing background and your journalism background before we get into talking about Mr. Graham.
Absolutely. My name is Frank Mastropolo. 27 years at ABC News 2020 got me into the writing and producing. And when I retired, I decided I was going to follow the topics that most interested me, which is music. Having grown up blocks away from the Fillmore East, I began to go there when it was the Lowe's Commodore, a movie house, as we called them. Then became the Village Theater, and I would attend shows there. And then when Fillmore East came in, that was my concert spot. I was fortunate enough as a kid to be interested in photography, as I was rotten in sports. So my friends and I had 35 millimeter cameras at a time when only professionals really had them.
Right.
And was able to photograph these fantastic artists, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and The Who, Traffic. Later on into retirement, I had done some interviews, early interview with Joshua on, it was the 45th anniversary of the Fillmore East debut. And as I reached out to musicians, I found that there was a great affection for both the venue and Bill Graham. Right. And they were effusive in their praise of both. And as interviews accumulated, I decided it might be a good idea to write a book.
Well, we should tell people that the book is two things about the book. One, it is really an oral history told by the musicians themselves, and the people behind the scenes and the attendees such as yourself, and that it is wonderfully illustrated, and a lot of that comes from your personal archive. I'd like to just start by giving some people who may not know Bill Graham a little background on Bill Graham before the Fillmore West and the Fillmore East, which is our subject matter. A little bit, if you could tell me a little bit about his life quickly, Frank.
Sure. Bill was, his trademark was his diverse lineups. I mean, they were unprecedented. He was born in Berlin, and he escaped pre-Holocaust Germany in an exchange of Jewish children for Christian orphans. Eventually moved to the Bronx, was a waiter up in the Catskills, and stint in the Army during the Korean War, and then went to San Francisco in the 1960s, the early 60s. He worked with the San Francisco Mind Troupe. They were performance artists and activists. He staged a benefit concert at the Fillmore Auditorium, saw that this was a great idea, and which was then called the Carousel Ballroom, and eventually, and Joshua can certainly expound on this, because he helped bring him here to New York. He eventually came to New York to launch Fillmore East
in March of '68, correct? And that was in the former. Were you involved at all, Joshua, in the Village Theater, or what was there before it became the Fillmore East?
The Village Theater, excuse me. The Village Theater was a sort of a derelict a theater, which was part of a whole group of really full scale theaters that were built in the early part of the century, because that was where that was the Jewish neighborhood. That was so it was the Yiddish Broadway. And there were a lot of them still left. One of the bigger ones was the old, I'm not even sure what it was originally called, but it was the Lowe's Commodore, a movie theater for a long time. And it had fallen into disuse. And the neighborhood, the Lower East Side, had gotten shabby. This is in the 60s. Post-war, and people were putting on concerts there, but not really with any great style, and certainly not much production.
Right.
And we, in fact, had worked with Bill Graham the summer before in a modern theater in Toronto. I had a company that would do any kind of lighting or effects. We didn't know much about light shows as they were being practiced in San Francisco and in London. We knew what they were. We knew about them, and we'd been to the Electric Circus. But there was really no place for us. And then we were lucky. We got hired to provide support when Bill Graham brought a week of The Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane to a formal modern theater in Toronto. And we provided all the production support, and I did the lighting, which was simple. And part of the production support was supporting a San Francisco light show and finding a way that they could perform without taking over the whole balcony.
What were the early days of the Fillmore East like? I mean,
it was a rush. But fortunately, there were a couple of things. One is I really wanted to do the light show, and after we had our Canadian experience, we decided we would change our focus. Remember, we're all kids. We changed our focus to doing light shows, and we got a week in Mineola in a theater there. Because they were putting on a pre-Christmas set of concerts, and we went and did that. And then we found that Crawdaddy Magazine was going to promote concerts across the street at the Anderson Theater, another one of the Yiddish theaters. And it was really, the people doing it were just not that interested in anything but the money. And remember, it was all cash in those days. And we couldn't get Bill Graham to come to New York, and we talked about it, meaning come to New York to open a theater. It was so obvious. But Bill had started his adult life in New York, and he was a failed actor. He in New York did not click, but he had great success in San Francisco, and we were doing these sellout shows in this awful theater, and Bill came to New York and saw how Janis Joplin went over, and he decided he would go for it, and he bought the Village Theater across the street, and we just all went with him in something like 3 or 4 weeks. We cleaned it up, we put it in the light show. Everybody did everything. I painted the box office. It was like summer stock, and it was a success from that day on.
Well, let's talk about, I think the most, one of the most amazing things about Bill Graham and his vision was the unique booking policy. Frank, I'm going to throw it to you for this one. He would use sort of these popular headliners to introduce young audiences to jazz folks. I actually was looking for Virgil Fox live at the Fillmore, which I could not find. But let's talk about some of the more inspired lineups. I'll start with you, Frank, and then you can voice in Joshua.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, Bill Graham would, his policy was a roots artist, a new artist, and a headliner on the same show. And by roots, I mean blues artists, jazz artists. I mean, he had Miles Davis there and Charles Lloyd, B.B. King and Albert King. These were artists that rarely, if ever, performed for young white audiences of rock fans. Graham managed Santana and really brought them to national attention, bringing Latin music.
Right.
Bill was a big Latin music fan, as I read, particularly dance. And he would bring Tito Puente,
Mongo Santa Maria, the whole orchestra.
Right.
Yes.
And they weren't the headliners.
Right.
And that gives you some sense of the quality of production that they could do there.
Yeah.
They could bring on a full orchestra as a middle act, get them off, and not have the evening go on forever, because everybody loved Bill, loved the music, and we all figured out how to do it.
Well, now we're going to drop and listen to some music recorded live at the Fillmore East. It is Miles Davis. I believe it's the Saturday version of Directions from Live at the Fillmore.
Miles Davis.
Okay, we're back, and you gentlemen both seem very fresh at this time of day, and I just wanted to talk now about the epic lengths of the shows that would go on at the Fillmore, and I believe they would go on till 6 in the morning sometimes, and if you could talk a little bit about that, and maybe a little bit about where people would go after to unwind after these shows.
Yeah, and also just before we begin that, I'll give you a little anecdote that you may want to include.
Sure.
it was customary for Bill to announce the bands, and when Bill couldn't do it, the manager, who was for most of the time Kip Cohen, would introduce the bands. And we had this odd weekend where John Mayall was coming, and he was going to record his album there, his famous Turning Point album. And the stage manager had stage fright. And for some reason, the next person in line to announce the band was me. So I come out on stage, and the guys in the sound booth would always do it from IQs. And they knew who I was, but they didn't know what I was going to do. I step up to the microphone and I go, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Mayall." And nobody hears me because they hadn't turned the mic on. So he asks me to say it again, and this time I say, "I'll say it again, John Mayall," and then they play one of the most extraordinary sets ever. Mm-hmm. It turns out it's the first thing on the record.
Wow.
So it's my claim to fame. Ladies Great. And gentlemen, John Mayall. And
wow.
I just like to have that anecdote in case.
Sure. Well, we're going to get into, we love the anecdotes, and there's a whole bunch of them in Frank's book from various folk.
But back to your question.
Yeah, yeah, sure. About the 6 a.m. closures.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a curfew? Was there? It seems like in these days, I just believe recently, or like in the last 2 days, I believe Coachella was it, got sued a lot of money because Lana Del Rey went like 5 minutes over on her set. Did those things not exist in those days?
Not that I'm aware of. If the band was loved and good, they could do what they wanted, especially that last show.
Well, let's talk about some of the great live recordings that were done there. The place, as you could tell from Frank's book, was beloved for the lighting and the sound and the way Graham treated artists. So obviously there's a great litany of live recordings made there. We started the show actually with one of them, the Allman Brothers Statesboro Blues. So if you guys want to tell me maybe about some of your favorite live events there, and if you were actually present for some of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Frank?
Well, yeah, I was present for John Mayall. We were present for all of them, and I know you want to focus on the music and play music. I would just say that one of the reasons why it was a popular place to record was because anyone who wanted to come in and record, remember, things were very primitive. We're talking 8-track recordings now. Anyone who wanted to do stuff, they were welcomed. They were treated properly. And this is just an anecdote to support it, is that when an engineer like Eddie Kramer came in, and he'd have a little noise in his system, and it was coming, he'd trace it down, it was coming from some of our dimmers in the light show, and without question we removed them because everybody wanted it to be good. It was
right.
I'm not sure I've seen that kind of cooperation,
right?
And so the Allman Brothers, and I don't think there were any bad performance albums from the Fillmore because it was so alive, and but it's I don't connect as much to the recordings as I do to the experiences. So Frank might be better to answer.
Well,
you know,
I was slightly too young to go there, so this is all that a person like me has. But I do have friends who are slightly older who actually lived in the moment. Mm-hmm. But Frank, if you want to tell us about some of your favorite moments there, maybe.
Well, I was not there, but had the privilege of talking to some of the people that were involved. Okay. And one of the most famous was John Lennon and Yoko Ono appearing by surprise at a Mothers of Invention show in June of 71. At that point, it was very close to the theater closing. But I spoke to some of the folks involved, including Ainsley Dunbar, who was the drummer in the Mothers. And that was quite an event with one of the, I guess the low points would be putting a canvas sack over Yoko as she was performing. Mm-hmm. It was a planned thing that Howard Kalin, one of the Flo and Eddie, dreamed up beforehand. But that was just an iconic concert that led to two live recordings. It was the contract stated that Zappa would have a copy of the master tapes and Lennon would have a copy of the master tapes. And so they both released their own live albums.
Right. Cool. And some more was just recently released by the Zappa Family Trust. And right now, I guess, is a good time to just drop in a little of that show. This is Frank Zappa wailing away on Willie the Pimp, Part 2. We're back, and you have so many great anecdotes in this book. I just picked out a few that I'd like you to chat about. I think you talked to Doug Clifford of Creedence Clearwater about their amazing amount of encores. If you could tell us a little bit about that show.
Doug was a very big fan of Bill Graham's, they performed what Graham told him was the most encores he had ever seen at any concert, gave them all gold watches, which one of them lost in Hawaii. And then he asked Bill to replace it. He would be willing to pay for it, but Bill said, no, I'll send you an engraved watch on me. It was such a terrific set of concerts that you did. They were always, Bill appreciated them because they were so professional. Drug use, always on time. Came in for the rehearsals and sound checks. And that was a recurring theme in talking to musicians, was the famous Bill Graham temper, especially when people did not come in on time, disrespected the house, disrespected the audience. I'm sure Joshua can.
He would say the word respect all the time. That was one of his key phrases. Show some respect. Mm-hmm. These people did this. These people did that. Respect. And I think they got it. It's certainly nobody argued with.
Yeah. And then were you there? There's another funny. This is a funny incident in the book. I believe it was a Steve Miller concert where Mungo Jerry opened and gave out 500 kazoos. Was that something that you were there for, Joshua?
It'd be their first time in the United States. And they come to a place where
they're going to be treated really well because of among other things, technical problems.
Right.
You know, your Hammond B3 organ that runs on 50 cycles in London may not work so well, but there'll be these guys down there just redesigning it, reworking it, and making it all work. It was a great first stop on an American tour. And these tours were kind of primitive in those days.
Right. Joshua, Frank, are you there on the to speak about this Mungo Jerry incident?
Yes. Steve Miller was so effusive about his shows there. He had already opened for Miles Davis, and he had opened for Neil Young. But then he finally got the headline, and his supporting act was Mungo Jerry. You know, they had the hit In the Summertime.
Right.
So Steve appears at the theater, and he sees the marquee says Miller Mungo, which set him off immediately. Well, he goes on, and Mungo Jerry opens. And at the end of their set, they throw 500 kazoos out into the audience. And Steve basically closed the anecdote by saying, could you imagine what it's like coming out and there's 500 kazoos in the audience?
Yes. Well, it's odd that they threw it out at the end of their set. It seems like a sort of a point of sabotage. The only thing that could have been worse is those, what they call vuvuzelas, those horns that they use at the Brazilian soccer matches. And tell us about the time that Peter Townsend punched out a cop, or almost punched out a cop.
Me?
Yeah, whoever.
Well, basically, there was the Fillmore was one of these classic old theater buildings where there was like a loft building on Second Avenue, and this loft building went all the way through to the depth of the other buildings. And then the full theater house, the audience part and everything, was then built behind it. And it was very common to have a store not in the same building, but next door. And there was a market which caught fire. And even though the Fillmore was basically up to code and that fire was not likely to spread either into the theater or backstage, smoke did come in. Mm-hmm. And the fire department showed up, of course, and the Who were in the middle of playing in their, and they were creating their own universe, and they just wanted to clear the theater. And some poor detective comes out on the stage and tries to stop, to say, get out, there's a fire. And the Who had no way of knowing. It was just a guy in a suit. Right. I think Peter Townsend clocked him with his guitar, which was very common for him. And
yes, what's that?
It all got settled, but it was just, and they did clear the theater, and everything was okay. But it was just one of those silly moments.
I want to backtrack a bit and talk about your work, Joshua, and how you sort of developed it, and the principles that you worked at when you did your light shows at the Fillmore, and maybe how that's transitioned to what you might be doing now.
Okay. When I gave you my initial Who Am I basically started at the Fillmore because I didn't really know the direction. But what actually I began in the early 60s to study stage lighting because I thought that was what I wanted to do. So I went to a very important theater school and learned the techniques of stage lighting as it was practiced in those days. And I found after 2 years, I just didn't really want to be a lighting designer for the theater. It was too formalized, too unionized, too complicated. And I wanted to have a freer form. So I thought, well, then maybe I'll light for film and I'll become a cinematographer. So I went for 2 years to University of Southern California Film School. And then I just had it with school because every school was teaching techniques from a previous decade. Or earlier. And I came back to New York with just my mind open and I had lots of skills. And so I did everything. I did exploitation films, which weren't porn. They were just like Girl on a Chain Gang. I was a teenage mother.
Sarno?
And then the Beatles came to America in 64, and suddenly everything was turned on. It was all zap and pow, but nobody knew how to do it, but I did. And the fashion world found this little company I'd made. And so we were doing fashion shows, and all that was really happening was a model would, a slide would appear with her, and then she'd come walking through the screen. They were all just simple stagecraft. And but I wanted something else, but what hadn't happened yet was the real sense that there was a music. But I went out to San Francisco, and I went to the Fillmore, the old Fillmore, and I saw what they were doing there. The Electric Circus opened in New York, and I had all of these disciplines that I could apply, and the magic happened when I went to work for Bill Graham for just a job in the summer of 67, because we were able to figure out all of the issues. And so when the Fillmore opened, when he decided, really not many months later, 6 months later, to open the Fillmore, all the skills were there. The tickets were printed professionally. There were programs. There was proper ways of getting tickets. There were posters, because all of this was standard in the other worlds that we'd all been in.
Right.
So I'm a photographer and a cinematographer and a stage lighting person. So I was able, we were all able to work together. There was a very high level of technology, which just had not been around. Either you were going into an auditorium, which was a school thing, or you were trying to go into a theater, which was a tough union thing. And here's this completely free space, mm-hmm. and we could do whatever we wanted.
And
and Bill was very sensitive to that. So he knew, for example, that opened in 66. And as he went into the summer, the old air conditioning system, which worked because that was a big selling point for all movie theaters. He made sure there was a very high end technician there, a guy, one of our contemporaries, who just ran the air conditioning, just stayed there to make sure it ran okay, because he knew. And there was just so many things like that. And a desire to create a kind of stagecraft, to have some humor, so to execute it with simplicity, so that when you'd have the crazy world of Arthur Brown, and Bill wanted something special, we made a sedan chair, and for four shows they carried him down the aisle with his flaming headdress,
his flaming gasoline helmet, right?
And, exactly. Yeah, well,
Who were some of your favorite artists to work with and shows, I guess?
For me personally, my favorite of all was The Who, because they were giant stars, but they were playing this circuit. They hadn't moved into that Stones universe, which was already getting to be silly. And they weren't going nightclubbing with Andy Warhol. They were The Who. They were these four guys, and they would come out, and only two of them really sang, and these two guys would just sing their hits, and their hits were phenomenal. And then in the second year we were there, they booked an entire week to perform their new album, Tommy, every night.
Right.
And it's the first time I'd ever been in the world of a genuine smash where, friends of my parents' friends are calling me to see if I can get them tickets. And I never had that kind of experience of that kind of success, which was just interesting because it really defined a lot of the moments that we would see much more of in the future.
Well, let's speak about one of the, again, I wasn't present at these shows, but one of my favorite, I think one of the most astounding, was the performance by Jimi Hendrix, the Band of Gypsies shows on New Year's Eve January 1st. So could you guys tell us a little bit about that backstory? And I understand your work is actually on the back of the album.
Yeah. It's interesting because it was a New Year's Eve concert, and my job was simply to do a show that included a clock that was ticking down. And to support Jimi Hendrix, and it was not hard to do because his music, it just led us. We had this unusual advantage, and I'll just emphasize this again. In order for us to perform and not to intrude upon what was a formal theater, we were behind the screen. It was an enormous screen. It was like, you know, 30 by 40 feet rear projection screen. But when you're behind the screen and it's framing you out, you can do amazing things. Mm-hmm. And you know, that will come out as art on the screen. So it was not hard to keep up with him. And we always had something in reserve. We could do just hours and hours of completely original, mostly abstract videos. Every once in a while, we'd drop in a concrete image if I felt, and it was me, that it was relevant in some way to pulling together the abstraction. But it was something to look at that was abstract while you listened to the music.
Right.
And well, and that was really the key to the show. And because we were theater-based, and this is something I was always important to me, was we took responsibility. So when you came through the door of the Fillmore with your ticket and you got in, there was already a big Welcome to the Fillmore East sign on the screen, and it was moving slightly. And when the show was going to begin, everything went out. And when the band was announced, their name came up on the screen. And then we did our light show, and we knew, I could see the stage manager, we knew when it was going to end. And at the end of the last song, we'd bring their name up again. And then the screen would get pulled up while they changed the bands, which they did with dollies. They'd preset things. And while that was happening, we had half the screen. So we'd show movies and cartoons and funny slides and things.
Well, let's listen to a little.
And we never stopped until the last person left.
Yeah. Well, let's listen now to a little bit of that Jimi Hendrix show, mm-hmm. his greatest probably performance on the guitar, mm-hmm. something called Machine Gun. If you're on South the Blade, I want to talk to Frank on this. How did you mentioned Graham witnessing Woodstock? How did that play into his decision to basically close both Fillmores and how the business really changed with Woodstock?
Yeah, there. You know, it's funny. The you know, although he Graham always said that Woodstock changed everything in the rock promotion. Because groups that could play one show at Madison Square Garden would make the same amount as four shows at Fillmore East. It was interesting, though. He said in his book, and if you want a must-read, Bill's book, Bill Graham Presents, which he wrote in 1992, he talked about the fact that he was offered the Metropolitan Opera House by Sol Hurok, and
who was a famous entrepreneur mm-hmm. of that era, who would bring the Moscow circus to New York, and Bill wanted to be an entrepreneur. I just want to make sure we got that. His idol was Sol Hurok.
Yes, and what happened was, you know, he didn't want a wild. Hurok had the house for a month, and someone had canceled on. So he had the house for a month empty. So Bill approached John Taplin, who was the manager of the band.
Right. Wrote a great book himself recently.
Yeah. So he offered them $50,000 for a week of shows, and Taplin turned him down. He said, I could, you know, make more money. You know, this band could make more money doing one show. And at that point, Bill says, I knew that was it. But, you know, he didn't like groups like Alice Cooper and Kiss. And he found that the audiences were less demanding than appreciative. He also said that, he also said that the artists became more concerned with their chart position rather than making good records. And then when agents came in, you know, they wanted to book their package of clients. They didn't want to give Bill the freedom to put together his roots artist, new artist, headliner lineup. And finally, you know, I spoke to David Edward Byrd, who did so many of those great posters. And he was also asked to do the final poster, which had every artist's name on. And I'll tell you that the quote that Byrd told me, that Bill told me, he said, the drugs change from acid and pot to red wine and barbiturates. I'm just sick and tired of cleaning up vomit. I'm not going to do it anymore. We're closing. Wow. I think all those things combined to make the decision for him.
Well,
I stood next to Bill on the stage at Woodstock because I was having an equally difficult time, because even if I had had a light show there that was 200 feet wide, it would have meant nothing. And we didn't talk that much, but I could tell that we both felt the same thing, which was, this is really the end.
Yeah,
I was gone. I was gone. And afterwards, I stayed maybe 5 more months, and then I left.
Yeah.
You know, Sal, I would like to say, the musician interviews were great, but Joshua provided an entree to the Fillmore staff. Now, remember, the musicians were only there, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 weekends, but the staff members were there every weekend, and they had some amazing stories. You know, I spoke to Mark Rubenstein from Pig Light Show, one of the light shows that came after Joshua. He told me this story that Paul McCartney and then Linda Eastman, they were just dating, and she wasn't well known at the time.
Right.
Would come to Fillmore East, and they would go into Kip Cohen's office, the managing director there. Mm-hmm. They would put him in a wheelchair and a hat on him and a beard. And he specified, he said they paid for their ticket, and then they would be rolled out. Paul would be rolled out to the back of the orchestra, and they'd watch the show. In this case, it was a Mothers of Invention show.
Oh, wow.
Between the acts, they'd roll him back to Kip's office.
Mm-hmm.
And I scoured the internet to see if any, because I'd never heard that story, and I couldn't find that story anywhere. It fell into the range of stories of, it's too good to check.
Right.
But I had to check anyway. So I had interviewed Kip already, but I got back to Kip and I said, is that true? And he says, yeah. He says, it's happened a few times. He said, we'd take a couple of ushers. He says that were the only ushers that were in on it. And we'd bring them food and drinks. And he said they came by about 3 or 4 times. He said, and before the place closed, they sent him a note. They said, thanks for all your hospitality, Paul and Linda.
And she shot a lot of famous photography there, correct?
Yes. Yeah,
she was hanging.
The first poster that was just primitive, wasn't done by David Byrd or by any West Coast artist, was just Art Nouveau lettering and a picture of Janice and Big Brother. That was a Linda Eastman picture, 1968, opening night poster.
Cool.
She was known to us. I mean, we knew who she was.
Who were some of the among this? Let's keep it on the staff and yourself. And who were some of the favorite artists to work with, and maybe some that were a little more difficult, if you want to go there?
Yeah, my point of view, remember, is I was behind and above them, so I didn't. I personally couldn't stand the stuff that came along later, the Crosby, Stills, Nash, mm-hmm. Young, Taylor, Reeves, all that. It was just so pretentious, you know, because at that point they would come out, they'd be so stoned, they'd sing flat, and the audience would be jumping up and down, you know, just things like that. I was very much influenced and informed by the respect that these great old blues artists got. And when we would come to set up, because we were in residence, the sound check, as you know, goes backwards. So the headliner it rehearses in the afternoon, and the opening act is the last one to rehearse, mm-hmm. and then they leave that equipment up. So we'd come in, and very often it would be Albert King or B.B. King or mm-hmm. Freddie King or, you know, or somebody like that. And they would, and that's the music we would set up to. So that's my rap. That's what's deep inside of me is the blues.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Bill Graham had a lot of sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, but a lot of social macho going back and on with the, going back and forth with the Jefferson Airplane, who we also managed. So when mm-hmm. they come, then we'd always have to do something special.
Right. Now, the closest I ever got to being at the Fillmore East was, I believe, that PBS special. Mm-hmm. Were you part of it? Mentioned Albert King and the blues.
Yes. I was part of it. I'd already spun off and had been doing my next work, which was going to be in, it began as digital, as projected light shows, video right. projected light shows, where we would build a light show based on the bands themselves on a screen with a video projector. It was very primitive, but that was how I began. But I wasn't qualified enough to direct that show, and they brought in a good director from Canada, but I was very good at stage managing it because everybody right. knew me. So I stage managed that show.
And that was Albert King and the Byrds, and I don't remember who else there was.
Yes.
Yep. Yep.
Van Morrison,
and the Allmans.
The Allman Brothers.
Oh, the Allman Brothers, of course.
Yeah. Let's
talk about the Allman Brothers. It seems that the Fillmore was the place that made them. And I have a strange anecdote. I was involved in a business called the Rock and Roll Bus Tour of New York. It was a trivia tour. This was in the early 90s with Danny Fields. And we made the grievous error of saying that the Live at the Fillmore shot, the back shot where they're all smiling, was shot at the back wall. We were trying to match it for a TV producer. And of course, then we were corrected. And I believe it was in Macon. Wasn't shot at the Fillmore.
Yes.
Right. But tell us about were you there for those Fillmore shows?
Well, they were there a lot. They were yeah. there a lot. So they were much, much beloved. The inclinations of the staff, and certainly in my light show, was towards the Dead, the Allmans, Canned Heat. Mm-hmm. They liked that kind of sound. And so did I, but they liked, that kind of rough energy, mostly American material. They just right. seemed to, and as did the audience.
Right. And very, exploratory and improvisational, like a lot of, I assume your visual artwork was, you know.
Yes and no. The thing really about the light show was we never knew. We didn't rehearse.
Right.
But we could feel it in us. And because we were, again, I just emphasize this, we were always there. If they didn't want us, we just didn't perform. But that didn't happen very often. But we were always there, so we could listen for a moment and then interpret. And if we weren't sure, we could just pick a color and then mix it with something else. It mm-hmm. was a very lovely experience because we were, especially me, I was allowed to mix this giant, constantly changing background, which was reacting purely to the music, not to the performances on stage because I couldn't see them. And even when we put in a TV camera, I really never watched it. I just listened.
Yeah. So, Frank, who were some of your surprising interviews and anecdotes that came from this essentially oral history? It seems like a lot of the great books about rock these days are oral history. Lakes McNeil's book on the punk movement. I recently talked to Joel Selvin, who did a wonderful oral history on Sly Stone. So are there any other folks who kind of stand out above and beyond in terms of who you spoke to and what you can learn from them?
They were very generous with their time, and musicians have a way with words, I think, that are so funny and so profanity laced in some cases. I mean, John Lodge of Moody Blues talked about in 1968, it was one of their first real gigs in America. And Mike Pinder, who just recently passed
yeah,
away,
last couple days.
Was there, was using an early Mellotron. And So John said that he got a few songs in, and you know, Mellotron runs on a series of the tapes of 8 second loops. He said he got a few songs in, and all of a sudden the tapes were coming out of the back. He described them like they were coming out of the back like spaghetti. So Pinder was desperately trying to repair it, couldn't do it, and actually it was a funny line. John says, he said we actually played second fiddle to Roadrunner cartoons and Joshua's lights.
That's right.
That's right.
Only because rather than bore the audience, once we knew, we would entertain them, which made for a very solid evening.
Right.
It was interesting to see that some bands just didn't quite have the effect that they thought they were going to have on the audience, and others had an amazing effect. The audience was very adamant about what they liked and demanded encores.
Who was the audience? What was it comprised of? You tell us a little bit about the economics of it. The tickets were based today, you know, people mm-hmm. pay $40,000 to see mm-hmm. Taylor Swift. I mean, it was like $250.
The tickets were cash, first of all. I don't think there were any credit cards. You could come down to the box office and buy tickets, and then there'd be outlets all over the metropolitan area, record stores where you'd go buy the tickets. Right. It turned out that our mail order, I think, it was all a standard theater operating procedure, which was different than even what it was across the street at the Anderson, where, you know, basically the guy was standing there taking your money as you came to the door. Bill did that out in San Francisco. But in New York, it really was a theater. So if you had a ticket, it was a seat with that you were assigned to. And when you came in, an usher in a proper T-shirt with a flashlight took you to your seat. And if there was somebody in it, he'd get them out. That was a kind of raising the standard for the audience so that people were not afraid to go, even though the neighborhood appeared to be scared. The audience was a mixture initially of really young people, high schoolers, college students, because that was a big college neighborhood. But we'd also discover as it became more fashionable, we'd have movie stars and everybody. It was none of that velvet rope crap, but everybody, you could go there and have an experience, and you weren't going to get, there wasn't going to be a problem.
Well, that
was very important to that world, because it wasn't an environment. And when you went to the ballrooms, you wandered around, you had a smile on your face, you painted things on you. New York, it was theater.
Yeah. Well, let's we're going to have to wrap it up, but let's talk briefly about the afterlife of the Fillmore, the new Fillmore, the Saint. I used to take money out of the Emigrant Bank there. So what happened to the Fillmore? When did it end, and what did it become?
Well, I can begin by saying basically Bill just could not book the acts. And like everybody else in the early part of the 70s, it was a difficult time. The city was having problems. Bill took drugs. You know, he had his machines out in California were running great, and even though he hated the whole idea of it, he developed a big business doing stadium shows. The very thing that he hated. I think in his heart of hearts, he understood that this moment, this perfect moment, was of that perfect moment. But after Woodstock, everybody was just looking for the big payday. Everybody wanted to do it. And a lot of the people that worked on Woodstock spent the next year or more traveling around the world at someone's expense. Can we do a festival at the base of Mount Fuji? You know, it was a big business. So he just did the thing that it's enviable. He said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to close this theater. And he did. and held on to it for a long time. And eventually somebody took over the lease and tried to reopen the Fillmore. But again, you couldn't get the acts. It wasn't the same thing. It wasn't that naive period.
Well, we'll give you the last word, Frank, here.
Yeah, you know, before the Saint came in 74, in December of 74, it was a producer named Barry Stewart opened up what he called the New Fillmore East. And then when Bill Graham threatened to sue him, he changed the name to NFE. And it was interesting talking to Randy Bachman. That was when it was still Fillmore East, he played his last show with the Guess Who. They kicked him out of the band. He played his last show at Fillmore East with the Guess Who, and then he returned. He reopened NFE with the Bachman Turn Overdrive, flew in from LA and reopened the hall, but it didn't last long. They had a history of not paying the artists, and
that'll do it, a short amount
of time.
And I can give you just a little coda to that, which is that the name Fillmore East is owned by Live Nation, the Death Star of the concert business. And one of their genius ideas was to rebrand various theaters as the Fillmore East. There's a Fillmore East in Denver. There was a Fillmore East in New York at the, you know, in a historic ballroom that should never have had its name changed. And a year later, it went back to, you know, on Irving Place.
They should,
And I do business with them. They were opening a club in Seattle, and they're really event spaces, which can be called the Fillmore just because it has some familiarity. But there's nothing.
They
put a barrel of apples down at the entrance that are covered up. You can't even have them. Paint the walls red, hang some old posters, but it's nothing. And they wanted to have a light show behind the bar, and I made them want it to be projected. But it was something of a moment, a perfect moment, and I'm so glad it was there, and I'm so glad it's documented and so carefully thought about.
Yeah, well, thank you, gentlemen, and I think, well, at least that's not as bad as the CBGBs that is at the Newark Airport.
Correct.
Which I'm sure you'll fly into one.
I think that's about as low as it gets.
Yeah, that's as low as it gets. That's a tale for another time. I'd like to thank both of you guys for joining me, and rush out there if you want to learn more about the Fillmore. Frank's book is a fantastic resource, and that's it. Thank you, and join us next time for Reading is Funkdemental.